This is Uncle Don, freelance curmudgeon, bringing you the 315th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. I've been cleaning out a stash of framed pictures and posters that sat on a shelf in our basement for years. This has been an item on my must-do list to accomplish before the world ends on the 21st of December 2012, half hour later in Newfoundland. Behind a photo, I found an old envelope. It's a simple, flimsy airmail envelope, somewhat battered, bearing two stamps of Indonesia. The address is simply The Beach House, and in parentheses, Hippie House, Dili, Portuguese Timor. It's one of the few souvenirs I brought back from my Asia trip in 1971. Back in those ancient days, a steady stream of backpackers made their way overland between Europe and Australia. We all had our own reasons for doing this. Some were looking for enlightenment, some just for a taste of the exotic. We were following an established path, like leafcutter ants in the jungle. The trajectory was established by economics. We all sought the cheapest transport and accommodation. My motive was not a desire to see the world. I'd been living, working, and hitchhiking in Australia, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea for a year and a half. I was tired, and all I wanted was to return to California. Back then, a couple of airlines had a stranglehold on cross-Pacific routes. A 20-hour flight from Sydney to San Francisco cost about $2,000 minimum, a daunting sum in those days that would have eaten most of my savings. In my kicking around down under, I heard it would cost less to follow the Gringo Trail going west through Asia and Europe to North America. I had nothing to lose but my life and health, so the die was cast. I suffered all recommended inoculations, with the exception of gamma globulin, a protection against hepatitis. That was a mistake, as I later contracted the disease. I attended embassies in Portugal and Indonesia for visas, disposed of everything I owned that wouldn't fit in my backpack, and took off. I hitched from Sydney to Townsville, Queensland, then caught a bus to Darwin, Northern Territory. In Darwin, I joined a pileup of travelers awaiting cheap flight to Portuguese Timor, with a bush outfit falling far short of qualifying as an airline. Darwin was a dusty end-of-the-line community with no obvious reason for existence, unless it was, as they say, where the wagon broke down. I couldn't estimate the number of travelers hanging around town awaiting transport. Rental accommodation was sparse, and most were camping rough, dug into a hillside overlooking the sea. There was a constant agitation in town to roust those hippies, as there was no sanitation and they were accused of making a mess of the beach. I avoided this squatter camp and took the coward's route of bunking in a cheap rooming house. I hung around the beach and learned about the battle between townies and hippies. The litter blamed on campers was actually left by kids from town having beach parties. It was the hippies who went down in the mornings cleaning up the broken glass and garbage. Eventually, I got a seat on a small plane for the short flight to Timor. From the chaos and heat of Kupang, I joined a group of Westerners for the bus ride to the capital, Dili. This was my introduction to third world transport. It was in Timor that I learned the motto of local travelers, chickens don't leave home without them. Over the mountains and through clusters of huts they called villages roared our beaten-up gaudy bus, rumored to be driven by a retired kamikaze pilot. I never determined whether driving in this colony was supposed to be on the right or left. Against all odds, we arrived in Dili to find that Portuguese officials had developed a unique way of handling transient hippies. They'd built a three-sided corrugated iron shed on a concrete pad facing the beach. For one Yankee dollar as rent, travelers could stay there as long as they liked. It was the official way of keeping us from mixing with locals and causing problems. No one took them up on their offer of an indefinite stay, as Dili was somewhat short of facilities one might expect in a capital. Roads, such as they were, ran in no particular pattern, with no asphalt in sight. Commercial activity consisted of a number of Chinese shops and some dubious eateries. There were some government offices and a military post. That was Dili. I changed some dollars into local money, buying some postcards, and went to the post office for stamps. There, in the main post office, in the capital of Timor, they were unable or unwilling to break a bill worth no more than $10. There I learned another lesson in third world traveling. Avoid large bills and hoard small change. Our little shed had running water, a toilet and a sink where we could wash clothes and have a sponge bath. luxuries not readily available to local citizens. There was a logbook where people could add comments and read advice left by others. There was a letter sent from Indonesia by a considerate traveler and included in the log. I salvaged the envelope and carried it with me all the way home. It was coming across this old envelope that brought back memories of my trip. Flights from Timor to Bali were a monopoly of TAT, Transportes Aeronaves de Timor, with an office in downtown Dili. There was no schedule for this airline. Prospective passengers had to show up mornings at the office to see whether a plane had arrived. The pilot had a radio with a 10-mile range, so the airport had a few minutes' notice of a pending arrival. Day after day, a bunch of us traipsed to the office, staffed with 5 people, performing no visible functions except turning away prospective passengers, only to find there was no plane. Finally, we were rewarded with positive news. A plane had landed. At the airport, we found the reason for staff idleness. TAT's fleet consisted of 1 old DC-3 aircraft. The perimeter of their landing strip was littered with carcasses of similar craft stripped of components to keep this one baby flying. We boarded without having to pass through security, as no terrorist would have dared to join the already terrified. There was no flight attendant to see that our seatbelts were fastened. I don't recall seatbelts. Nor life jackets, and a part of the flight to Bali was over open water. I rather doubt that this plane was burdened with any instruments, considering the range of the radio and the fact that it followed coastline most of the way. I don't think it flew when visibility was obscured. I have only 2 souvenirs of my 6 months spent on the Gringo Trail from Australia back to the States. One was that envelope salvaged from the hippie house in Timor, and one a photo of me with some other travelers sitting outside the TAT office in Dili. Someone sent me that black and white photo later, as I carried no camera. I'm sure there are new Gringo trails all over the world now. They're fluid. Mine would no longer exist, as few folks would care to traverse Afghanistan or Iran these days, but China and Russia are now open, as well as parts of Africa and Latin America we could not visit. If you're young, healthy, unattached, and have a few bucks set aside, why not hit the road and see how the rest of the world lives before digging your life's rut? American television has gone all digital. Analog signals went off the air last week, leaving households with older television receivers and lacking cable or satellite dishes bereft of service. Oh, gods, there goes the birth rate again. Buried in stories of this technological shift was the fact that a whole 15% of American households live without cable or satellite service. This gross statistics hides 2 distinct classes of folks: those who use old-fashioned antennas to capture signals, and those, like us, where television is not a part of our lives. Yes, we own an idiot box, one of those old jobs with a cathode ray tube poking out the back. We use it to play VHS movies accumulated over the years from garage sales and thrift stores. My wife and I are holdovers from a class of folks who made the conscious decision not to let television into our lives. There are 3 good reasons for this. Most broadcasting is what has been aptly characterized as a vast wasteland. Friends defend their viewing by telling us of all the wonderful documentaries and wildlife shows we're missing. This may be true, but it seems odd that when we visit these same people and their televisions are playing, there are dumb shows on. Very odd. Our second reason for rejecting TV is the advertising. In the absence of a sponsor like the CBC, broadcasting in North America is financed by commercial enterprises purchasing access to the homes and brains of viewers. We don't want those rude intrusions into our lives, stoking our perceived needs for more junk. As for me, when television first came to our neighborhood, I watched avidly. At 16, I was packed off to a boarding school where there was only 1 TV set in the common room, and it was never on. From there, I went to college, then the military. I had no time for viewing in the former and no access in the latter. When I was finally granted my freedom again, I find that I had lost my taste for sitting before a light show in darkened rooms. There's too much else to do in life. I never went back. I've no idea how many other North Americans there are who, like us, have made the conscious decision to leave TV out of our lives, but it must be a lot. Certainly the number of people without access to electricity or who cannot afford even a small secondhand set is minuscule and represented mostly by the transient and homeless. We know that more homes own televisions than own refrigerators. So we are deprived of information as to what products are new and improved, what the fads are, who are the latest cult objects, the current gossip, and, best of all, the political attack ads about which we are forced to read in papers or hear about on the CBC. And don't get me started on commercial radio. North Korea's Minister of War was heard to say, "We will not stand idly by as America builds the capacity to wreak destruction on any target in the region or on us. We will not accept the United States of America as a nuclear state." Oh, wait a minute, I got that confused. That was Robert Gates, the misnamed U.S. Secretary of Defense, who made a similar statement in Singapore referring to North Korea. I apologize. Certainly, it would not be the place of North Korea to criticize the United States as a threat to peace, even though it is armed with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, on missiles and aircraft positioned to rain death on any point on Earth within minutes. Just because the U.S. is the only nation ever to have loosed the power of the atom on a prostrate enemy is no reason to believe that it would use those awesome weapons irresponsibly. It's obviously North Korea that is the greatest threat to world peace. It's somewhat handicapped in this role as the country never recovered from a war nearly 60 years ago. It has a moribund economy, a lack of natural resources, a Stalinist government, and suffered a series of loony dictators. It's a terrible worry to a nation with 700 overseas military installations, tens of thousands of soldiers on North Korea's southern border, and nuclear-armed navies around the globe. The American government squanders over half of the world's total outlay on preparations for war, yet the U.S. trembles in fear of mighty North Korea, a nation that cannot feed itself. I hate to sound cynical just because I'm cynical, but the hubris exhibited by the United States government leaves me dumbfounded. Or nearly so. Canada's dear leader has granted the 49th Aga Khan a rare award of honorary Canadian citizenship. He's only the fourth person to be granted this title and the privileges appertaining to his new status. I hope the recipient is aware of the baggage this carries. If he runs afoul of a foreign government, albeit at the behest of Canada, he may be accorded accommodation in the lobby of the local Canadian embassy. If he should find himself as a guest of American hospitality facilities in Guantanamo, he may have Canadian officials help refresh his memories of transgressions. And if, while in our country, he attracts unfavorable attention of our spy masters, he may be accorded free room and board in a secure setting without the bother of legal niceties. The Aga Khan should beware of geeks bearing gifts. Coca-Cola is going green. The corporation will use the Vancouver Olympics to launch its new plant bottle containing a variety of plastic made in part from sugar cane and molasses. They'll spend vast sums to convince their target consumers, those in the 13 to 29 age group, of their pristine environmental credentials. Poor Coke has suffered from its image as a despoiler of our environment. They stand accused of depleting foreign aquifers while polluting their lands and surface waters. Here at home, it takes 2.5 liters of water to produce a liter of Coke, but when all factors are considered, including the water taken to produce the sugar, the amount jumps to 250 liters. It'll be an uphill battle to convince consumers that using a barrel of water in making a bottle of their brew is environmentally sound, especially when their major competitor, tap water, takes 1 liter per liter to produce and sells for a fraction of a cent. The means of swaying the public will be the corporation's usual propaganda, very expensive propaganda. If you believe that this new green Coke is good for the environment, I suggest that you hustle your buns off to the nearest casino where fortune awaits you. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. It's official. Swine flu is now a full-blown pandemic. How are we supposed to respond to this? Does it mean that we must stock up on plastic sheeting and duct tape to seal our precious ones off from tainted air? Must we boil our water? Are surgical masks needed? I recall the oft-repeated advice dispensed in the lower ranks of the U.S. military. When in danger, fear, or doubt, run in circles, scream, and shout. This solves nothing, but it makes for an interesting displacement activity until something meaningful comes to mind. our government arose in well-publicized wrath at the audacity of Sri Lanka in refusing entry to Bob Rae on arrival to inspect their Tamil refugee camps. Perhaps they were fearful of criticism, a wholly unacceptable reason for ejection of a senior statesman. This smacks of grand hypocrisy, considering Canada's recent refusal to allow George Galloway, a respected member of the British Parliament, to enter Canada when he was invited to give a speech. Canada also forbade two American peace activists, Media Benjamin and Anne Wright, from coming to our Pure Land lest their planned lecture criticize our actions. We're sensitive to fault-finding by foreigners, but our citizens have a perceived God-given right to go to any land and expose their failings as interpreted by our government. Not long ago, everyone knew that religious belief was dying in the face of modernity. Science was eating away at creationism as evidence of the Big Bang and evolution grew. We seem to have been wrong. What we call mainline churches are shrinking in followers, but evangelical Christian churches worldwide are making an end run around both science and traditional beliefs. The following is my interpretation of what I've seen and read. I may be well off the mark. Bereft of bureaucratic structures, the cloud of fundamentalist churches, large and small, promise a personal relationship with a God who answers prayers, rewards the faithful, and punishes the sinful. Anyone can start a church in this free-for-all environment, and many do. They're united in believing the unerring truth of their Bible and its prophecies with the coming end times and rapture of the faithful. A major attraction is the promise of personal rewards here and in the hereafter. On earth, God rewards the faithful with aid in money, in relationships, and health. Evangelical Christianity is growing rapidly, especially in Africa and Latin America. This amorphous movement, like any other, has limits and challenges. Its success in promoting personal development, and especially education, could undermine fervent faith in miracles and the unbelievable. And it's coming head-to-head with the growing reach of Islam. The movement also seems to share one of the weaknesses of capitalism. Both thrive on growth. When a religion reaches its limits in converts, will it stabilize or shrink? Congregations appear to be consolidating into monster churches, which promise to be stifled with bureaucracy and financial concerns. Will there be a drop-off in membership when followers decide that belief does not automatically bring success? Religions, like political currents, are not stable. They can last for centuries like the Catholic Church, or they can flash by like comets. The unanswered question is how great the influence of Christianity will become before fading in the face of challenges like Islam and secularism. If all true believers disappear into the sky one day, we'll know for sure. The English language has now officially added its millionth word. Their usage varies. Only Conrad Black uses them all. Those with English as a second language use thousands. Canadian teenagers get by with a couple hundred. American soldiers in my day generally used a couple of dozen, half beginning with F. If there's now a million English words, I have a candidate for number 1,000,001. It is ignoramus, defined as one who is a complete ass but doesn't know it. We are surrounded with ignoramuses, some more obvious than others. A prime example is the guy at the party with the lampshade on his head. Ignoramuses rise easily through bureaucracies. I've worked under the direction of several. I humbly submit my contribution as ignoramus to those linguistic authorities with nothing better to do than compile lists of approved words. When financial collapse hit us last year, it caught everyone by surprise. Bankers, regulators, brokers, investment advisors, even New York cab drivers, all were taken unaware. Well, it seemed so at the time. I noticed lately a growing number of economic types are coming out of the woodwork with "I told you so" statements and articles. They knew it was coming. Funny thing. Now there's a phrase covering these belated visionaries. It is retrospective foresight. This is not actually a new phenomenon. You can find the same in interpretation of Nostradamus' obscure works, where experts are able to discern his predictions of events, but always after the fact. I'm not guilty of retrospective foresight in my warnings of a fiasco in the funding of Vancouver's 2010 Olympics. I've archived 7 years of scripts, many of which predicted this mess. This required no gift of foresight. All it took was an unbiased look at past Olympic exercises with a record of unmet fiscal targets, disappointing grand legacies, and white elephant facilities. Every one was promoted as a boon to the local economy, putting the host city on the map and enticing future mobs of tourists. Each was to break even. Looking at their history, we see that the public paid the cost of construction and ceremonies, while corporations, many of them foreign hotel chains and such, reaped whatever benefits accrued. Local businesses suffered loss of revenue from disruption of routines, and local citizens were left with the burden of paying down accumulated debts. It took Montreal decades to retire the massive debt left by an Olympics in the 70s, declared to be no more able to take a loss than a man could have a baby. Greece is left with crumbling monuments and massive debt from its hosting of the Games. In Vancouver, business along Cambie Street collapsed as the expansion of the rapid transit line for the airport chased away business. Need I mention the god-awful mess that is the Olympic Village, which was supposed to turn a profit for the city? Vancouver is expected to absorb overruns on budgeted costs in the neighborhood of $45 million, on top of whatever they lose on that athlete's complex. That is projected at a cool $100 million. Even the office tasked with overseeing the Olympic housing project is over budget by more than $1 million. Meanwhile, Vanuk boasts that it will blow $38 million on opening ceremonies alone. Not included under the announced cost for this two-day party is the ongoing attempt by Vancouver to clean up Skid Row. This would be worthwhile if it were a permanent operation, but sure as anything, the Lower East Side will return to squalor right after the Games. Our federal and provincial governments have budgeted $380 million for Olympic construction. How many permanent residences could have been built for the homeless out of that money? I will here venture another prediction. Whatever Canada squanders on this 2010 Olympic mess will be dwarfed by losses to be incurred by Great Britain in staging their games in 2012. Their exultation at London beating out Paris for their bid for the Summer Games has turned to fears of massive cost overruns and decreased revenues. Watch this one. I found $1 million one morning last week. There it was, lying right on the ground, a $1 million bill. If Mulroney had known about this, he wouldn't have had to burden himself with bulky envelopes stuffed with thousands. But alas and alack, this bill read, "Not legal tender." Damn, eh? I haven't been fooled like that since I turned my retirement funds over to Bernie Madoff. There was small print on the back of this counterfeit money, warning me that I am destined for hell if I have transgressed divine rules during my lifetime. The bill read, quote, "Will you go to heaven? Have you ever told a lie, stolen anything, or used God's name in vain?" Close quote. It went on to ask whether I've ever looked at a woman with lust in my mind. Uh-oh. If I've done any of these things, the note claims that God sees me as a lying, thieving, blasphemous adulterer. Ouch, and I thought I was a nice guy. I guess it depends on your perspective. Fortunately for the faithful, God sent a surrogate to earth to clean my slate if I just believed in his existence. But suppose that God decides not to honor that promise of forgiving us sinners. Heaven could be a strange place. It would consist of just four adults: Jesus, Joseph, Mary, Mohammed, and a billion babies who died before the age of two. I've no desire to be a fifth wheel who couldn't even be fitted into a heavenly bridge game, so I'll continue to sin in hopes of joining my friends when I die. Let me be perfectly clear, as politicians are wont to say. I do not qualify for heaven. Even at my advanced age, there's a spark of lust in my eye when I see a pretty girl. I have stolen and I have lied. My language is sprinkled with blasphemies, often colorful and hyphenated oaths, taking the name of the Lord in vain. Also, I am an unrepentant heathen, having no God nor gods to which I am beholden. I trust that this disclaimer assures one and all that I am not qualified to be canonized into the growing ranks of sainthood. According to my will, my earthly remains are to be cremated and disposed of in an environmentally responsible manner. Under no circumstances would I want my body butchered, with bits FedExed to churches and cathedrals around the globe, as seems to have been the fate of many chosen as saints. This would not have occurred to me had it not been for the fact that some bizarre thief heisted a piece of the corpse of one St. Therese from its place of display in St. Michael's Catholic Cathedral in Toronto. This bit of bone or human jerky, once separated from the holy carcass, became a relic. I envision a cottage industry of grave robbers converging on the graves of saints, only to butcher and distribute the bits which will be put on display or awarded to children for memorizing bits of Bible verse. Not for me, thank you, nor anyone I know. Yuck. But don't get me wrong. I'm not one to disrespect the dead, nor do I particularly respect them. We all have our time on earth, and we're all destined to die. In a society like the North American, not cursed with ancestor worship, the ordinary deceased are forgotten in a generation or two. That's fine. Although we should know our history, one can get too hung up on the past individuals. We come into this life, live a few decades, if lucky, and are gone like the flame of a snuffed candle, only to be replaced by a generation too taken with its own concern to be much worried about the dead. As to the fine accomplishments of our ancestors, none of us, past, present, or future, actually contributes to the long-term health of the planet. From our first breath, we add to the carbon dioxide, which will be the death of our civilization. Saint and sinner, we are all complicit. Great effort is expended in search of methods to lower the carbon in our atmosphere, while even greater effort goes into corporate propaganda trumpeting those efforts. Obviously, no technology can keep up with the massive carbon releases for which we are responsible. Capturing cattle farts for storage in limestone caves will not balance the burning of fossil fuels. We live on a planet of 6.5 billion people, infesting a world that, without the use of fossil fuels, could support perhaps a couple of 100 million, and only if those were optimally distributed. Mother Nature came up with a perfect method of carbon capture millions of years ago. She gradually stored it in underground in the form of coal, oil, and natural gas. What she did in eons, we are undoing in mere centuries. We're captives of our technology and the exponential growth of human populations. Enjoy the party while it lasts. Canada's fearless leader proposes opening employment insurance to the self-employed. I don't know whether he threw this idea out as a red herring to divert Ignatieff from more pressing matters, or whether he was, for a change, sincere. In first glance, allowing employment insurance to those running their own businesses is fraught with peril. I think of all the scammers who would love to milk the system behind the guise of running small businesses. It seems loony, but maybe Harper is crazy like a fox on this one. To be eligible, a person would have to establish a small business front. This would entail bookkeeping and, presumably, profits on which taxes would have to be paid. Before drawing benefits, a track record of legitimate business would have to be fabricated. In a percentage of these plans, the individuals could accidentally find themselves in viable pursuits and lose track of the goal of milking the federal government. An expansion of coverage could also entice those now in the gray economy into open operations, again reporting income and paying taxes. Wouldn't it be ironic if this trial balloon grew legs, to mix metaphors horribly, actually coming to pass and working? This concludes the 315th presentation of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM. Ambrose Bierce's definition of man reads, in part, as an animal which multiplies with such insistent rapidity as to infest the whole habitable earth and Canada.